Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of season 3 of A Theatre Maker Mzansi. As you know, we're going to be, or maybe you don't know, we're going to be continuing our conversation with Monageng Vice Mochabi. Today, we're going to be delving a little bit deeper into his production company, Di Arts Monageng. We'll consider the relationship between his name and the production company's name, Monageng, Di Arts Monageng, thinking a little bit more about this notion of Naga, right? And you'll find out what that word means if you don't already know. And then we also look at the work that he's done as a publisher, and we think about what it is that you might do in order to be published by Di Arts Monageng. And so we're going to be having a lovely continuation of the conversation that was started in the last episode. So if you didn't get a sense of what happened in the last episode, I'd suggest you go back to that episode, listen to it, and then carry on with this one. So yeah, that is it for the intro for this particular episode, Theatre Maker Mzansi season 3, episode 3, Monageng Vice Mochabi part 2. Here we go. Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of season 3 of A Theatre Maker Mzansi. As you know, we're going to be, or maybe you don't know, we're going to be continuing our conversation with Monageng Vice Mochabi. Today, we're going to be delving a little bit deeper into his production company, Di Arts Monageng. We'll consider the relationship between his name and the production company's name, Monageng, Di Arts Monageng, thinking a little bit more about this notion of Naga, right? And you'll find out what that word means if you don't already know. And then we also look at the work that he's done as a publisher, and we think about what it is that you might do in order to be published by Di Arts Monageng. And so we're going to be having a lovely continuation of the conversation that was started in the last episode. So if you didn't get a sense of what happened in the last episode, I'd suggest you go back to that episode, listen to it, and then carry on with this one. So yeah, that is it for the intro for this particular episode, Theatre Maker Mzansi season 3, episode 3, Monageng Vice Mochabi part 2. Here we go. So Di Arts Monageng, how did this come about? So firstly, I'm curious about the relationship between your name, Monageng, and the name of the company, Di Arts Monageng. And then just this notion, Yanaha, you know, and what does that do and facilitate and hold for you? And reflect on that.
Yeah. There are many ways of thinking about that, or many ways that I think about
okay.
it. At a very basic, obvious level, is that, yes, Monageng and Di Arts Monageng is essentially an experience of my world.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's, you know, this is the arts as I experience them, as I see them, you know, as I propose they should be experienced.
Yeah.
And then there's another way of thinking about Naga as Naga, the wilderness.
Yeah.
You know, Latini, which is what my name also really speaks to, the idea of being a wanderer, one who is always everywhere but where they should be.
Uh-huh.
you sure. know, yeah, yeah. Or where they're expected to
right.
be. Yeah. So wandering out there,
yeah.
Which in many ways is also the way in which my life unfolds, that I've lived it, that I always feel like I'm not where I should be. Like, you know, if you go to that biblical reference, yeah, 40 days and 40 nights
right.
in the wilderness.
Right. Right.
Know,
yeah.
It feels like
your life is.
I've spent a lot of my life in that in 40 that wilderness. Day, 40 nights.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still waiting to come back to myself.
Right.
You know, so it feels like that. And that can be very uncomfortable. Mm. Thing to navigate, to feel in your body but far from yourself
mm.
as well. So there's that. I don't know how that bleeds into the work. I mean, I'm just doing the work from that same place, so I don't really know how it manifests from other people's, you know, points of view.
Mm.
But I'm aware that there is that tension, that the work is made from that place, from a desire to come back to self. You know, come back to a place that is not Konache. You know, that feels a little different from Konache. But I may just find that because that's my name, that's who I am.
Right.
That it might always be Konache.
Right.
That I might just have to make peace with the idea that that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's my life, you know. So there's navigating that. But I'm not always sure how it speaks to the vision of the Kampai.
I see.
But it may just be speaking to the idea that I'll always be doing stuff that maybe other people aren't doing.
Right.
I'll always be filling gaps that other people aren't looking at.
Right.
Because I'm looking at it from Konache, you know. I'm checking it out from the wilderness of this experience. So maybe I'm always going to see some of those things that only I am meant to be dealing with in the way that I am.
Right.
You know, so maybe there's that.
Mm.
But there's also a literal desire to step away from making in the city in the way that I am, to go into almost occupy a place, komachayim somewhere, and to go and create work in a village somewhere, you know, between a body tabbing where there are rivers running and whatever, to actually make the arts Konache in a real sense. You know, so there is also that. There's a desire that's consistently there.
Sure.
You know, feeling like I might thrive if I didn't live in this city in the way that I do.
Uh-huh.
And not, I don't mean thrive economically, but I think in a more holistic way. If I step,
you might come back to yourself.
Yeah, it feels like that. It feels like the need to abandon the city and to go look elsewhere. But we'll figure that out when we are ready for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So how did the company come into being, and what is its vision, so to speak?
Yeah, the company was born out of a desire to create independently. I've always known anyway that I don't quite belong to the
so-called mainstream.
And I don't mean that I shouldn't be making work at a level that's considered mainstream.
Right.
I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
I just mean that my experience of the arts is not determined by the notion of an industry and the way those politics and games are played.
Yeah.
I don't subscribe to that, so therefore I've always said to students that your desire to create, it has nothing to do with the idea that there's an actual industry. You know, that the thing that makes you want to create is bigger than the idea of the society industry as it has defined itself.
Right.
And the industry as it has manifested now.
Yeah.
It might be that what you bring is going to help expand whatever that notion of an industry is, or is going to contribute to it in a new way. So don't make that thing some kind of god to look up to. Because the thing that is in you that is responsible for your dreaming and desiring is a lot bigger than all of that.
Mm.
And therefore, the thing that requires more attention is that thing that is burning in you. And not what's outside. So I had the capacity to be stubborn in that way, in resisting to follow a certain logic, you know, and to try and pay attention to my own interior or internal logic, you know, as a way of following some invisible map. By just listening, doing what I feel like doing and not doing what I don't feel like doing, you know, resist refusing to do certain work if I don't feel like, you know, doing it, and learning from trial and error, also by taking on jobs that offer me a lot of money and very little inner fulfillment. Yeah. You know, so always navigating that space in a way that has felt balanced to me.
Yeah.
by always going back to me.
Yeah.
Me, what else? Yeah. What are these ones? So the company was started as a way of trying to provide a space to operate within that feeling, within that understanding, and still make economic sense to myself.
Right.
Because I like living in the way that I live.
Yeah.
My life. I like having access to money.
Yeah.
I like life to be soft.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I know I have to make those things happen. So then I was dreaming up a way of making those things happen. Publishing was one of those things that I had always felt that I wanted to do. I don't know when it started exactly, but I have so many proposals from many different years that had something to do with publishing. That no one understood, maybe. I mean, not that they don't know what publishing is, but they didn't understand why I thought that was a thing to do. And after realizing that no one's going to give me money to do this thing, actually.
I'm just doing it myself.
I must just figure it out and pull it out there. I mean, after I registered the company, I proposed to do many different things. You know, I was trying to publish Gibson Kenter's texts. I was trying to do a whole Gibson Kenter experience, drawing from his business acumen and, you know, the kinds of things that he had achieved. So I wanted to do a whole sort of three-phase project that had to do with drawing from his inspiration in some way. You know, that was the first major project that was intended for the company. And that didn't work for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I started, when I started framing this publishing thing, is I went for some business incubation. I was part of some incubator. And I started feeling like bouncing it on up and on, because, you know, there was no understanding of the world that I'm coming from, to the creative sector, and therefore a lot of the suggestions were always going against what I felt in my gut was the way to do it.
Kind of like the blocking again.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, so I'm going to step out of here and just go and do this thing.
Yeah.
And I did. I just, one day I was like, okay, I have enough money in my account to take a risk. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And is this what led to reading the palms?
Yes.
Okay. Talk to us about that. How did that come about? It's a long process, right?
No, it's not only just the length. I'm trying to remember the details of the exact. Uh-huh.
So maybe let me ask a more direct question. How did you select the plays that were in there?
Oh, yes. Hallelujah, I'd always liked. I saw it when I was a student.
Yeah.
And I was working as an usher. I saw it a few times then. And it remained in my mind as one of those plays that happened at the market and never came back.
Mm.
And I felt like there was a need to re-experience this play in some way,
because
I thought it had been so impactful at the time. And then I came across Paul's Interracial. It also is one of those plays that never really had a life as a production. They never actually gave it a season, even at the State Theatre. You know, it was performed as part of Festival Yabona, in Zanzi Fair or something, for a few days there. So here was a play that touched a nerve. It was a play that was significant in the history of the play in South Africa, where Paul had suddenly gone to a place where people were uncomfortable, they thought he was unfair. People walked out of the theater. White people were generally offended.
Right.
And he had his side of that story. which had to do with his experience in putting up a play and casting white actors in it, and
right.
a play about race.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what was the deterrent, or if they just didn't want to work with him because of whatever perception they had of him, either as a director or as a black person. I'm not sure
what
the actual reasoning was, but they refused.
Yeah.
The ones who he tried to invite.
Cast, yeah.
So then he had to change the play so that it works with the
all black
cast,
yeah.
and still include the white role in it and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And when I saw it, I thought it was such an accomplished, multi-layered experience, just at a level of form. So many things are going on in the play, and I didn't think this was a play that should just disappear. I thought this play had to find its way and be available, so that even if it's 10 years from now, you know, someone will find it who will do it justice, and it'll either as a historical experience or something that says to us, we are still here where Paul was all those years ago.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an important play.
Mm.
The agenda was clear for me, that the publishing had to be to give room or space to a certain kind of black work, because the other publishing that was happening was the company in Cape Town that also published this place, and a lot of the plays that I had seen that they had published seemed to have some kind of agenda that my body was uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
It felt like these are the plays that are acceptable to whiteness because they
that couching work that you spoke about earlier.
Right. It's like they basically present black people in a light that is not favored, that is sometimes unpleasant, so they don't like it when you point towards the source of the problem.
Right.
They enjoy seeing the problem in a way that seems to suggest that we are the problem.
Right.
Because we're the ones sitting with this problem.
Right.
It's for the same reasons why a play like Paul's play, what's the name of this play now? So, it's a play that...
Cards.
No,
After The President's
Cards.
Man.
Township Stories.
Oh, Township Stories. Relativity.
Relativity. Yeah. So a play like that, which, you know, is about, I suppose, the dark side of living in a township.
Yeah.
Where, you know, all that violence, and, you know, raping and murder.
Yeah.
And to, like, people feasted on this, and I was intrigued by how a number of white people loved that play. I was like, what is it that you're so moved by? Like, that you're seeing savages? That there's a part of you that gets peace from the finger?
Oh, they do it themselves.
Look at what they're doing to each other.
Right.
You know, as though there is no history to this. As though there is no
prior context.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know? And so it has things like that, seeing stuff like that made me think I needed to create a platform for another view of us by us, an intra-racial conversation of sorts, and a play like Hallelujah, you know, touches on that intra-racial conversation in its own way. Difficult one, but nonetheless, the idea that there are things that we might have to deal with amongst ourselves, where we might point a finger at ourselves and say, hey, look, you know, there's something in your eye, you know.
Is that similar to the notion ya khari tebe?
It's the same thing.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Right.
This is why I was offended at that time when, you know, Fiona had staged that play, you know, Hallelujah, and it was, I'll send you the thing.
Sure.
I was just offended by the take on it, and the fact that lekhwale le batla in this conversation, because I mean, really, kida kiulo na kuta kiba kwabo, so lekhwale le
kena
how direct our director.
Yeah.
What conversations are we having in this rehearsal room?
Yeah.
So I was just offended by it. And that's something that I had held on, that I had felt rather since I was a student when I saw the play. But I just show how I did about that.
Yeah.
Why about Hatile?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the third play was me and the halves.
Yeah, and my relations. Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and yeah, and
there's this intrasubjective notion of a grappling with blackness.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So that's why I had those three plays in that book. Yeah, and it was a fulfilling experience.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it set the tone, you know, to say this is what I'm interested in. This is what I'd like to protect or present. This is the work that I'd like us to have available 30, 40, 50 years from now.
Right.
That people can have this to play with, to explore as plays that are a testament of the times we live. So that was the drive behind that first one. And, yeah, and of course I wanted to create a contrast so that while that other company thrives in whatever they do, they can do something else that allows for work that they may not be interested in to have a life.
So then I'm curious about, so there's the space in between Reading the Palms and The Red on the Rainbow. There's collaborations, there's collaborative work, there's Between the Pillar and the Post, there's KKK, there's Hauntings.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about what is it that moves you to collaborate with other makers in the publishing space? You know, what gives you the impetus to say, this is something that I want to be involved in? This is something that I feel like would fit within this notion of, you know, bonaheng, this notion of outsiderness, this notion of not being seen by, you know, the so-called conventional, so-called traditional publishing house that might give voice to all of this other work that locates blackness in this kind of oppositional space. What makes you then move towards collaborating with, you know, Jeff, with the lab, with the Writers Lab, and all that kind of work?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is the same impulse, but the second part of it is realizing that other people have a need for this that is beyond my personal one.
Right.
That there's a need to shape the vision to not just be contained in we're doing just this kind of work, but to say we are creating an archive of new contemporary South African theatre.
Mm.
And it still has to be theatre that in our eyes speaks truth to power in its own way. Or if it doesn't do that, it is not work that openly pieces on blackness.
Right.
And that's an important thing, that the work is not disrespectful.
Denigrating.
It doesn't denigrate us, nor the agenda, of the foundation of this company.
Mm.
So, but it's realizing that building an archive is a shared interest, that there are other people who value the idea of publishing for different reasons from my own, and that I may have to open myself up to that so that I'm not just obsessing with this one agenda, but that I'm expanding towards creating this archive of South African contemporary theatre. And I think that's of value to me, and in that way I have allowed myself to stretch beyond let's just make work that is of the tone that my personal interest is, you know. And we'll always go back to that. There'll be many of those experiences, but I felt that the collaborations was me opening up towards coming towards me that feels like it's helping expand towards a broader function than my personal agenda,
right,
which hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You know, my agenda is still the same.
So say a young, not even young per se, but somebody who's feeling like they want to develop their own work. I mean, one of the places where this particular podcast is going to be engaged with is at this reading room event that's going to be at Theatre Arts in Cape Town. And one of the things that they are doing there is to think about how do you start getting people excited about playwriting so that we can start developing this new contemporary archive, you know, of work that is reflective to the current times that we find ourselves in. And I think there's something really valuable in thinking through this question of the contemporary without necessarily bending to the will of the accepted norms, right, in terms of how the contemporary is framed, you know, and how, you know, who gets to decide, you know, which stories then come to the fore. So if somebody's thinking, you know, I have the similar desire to create multifaceted work that presents identity in these broad kind of strokes that do not necessarily denigrate a people but lift up stories of interest that can engage new audiences in really radical ways, you know, what do you, how do you advise people who maybe then want to say, I want to publish my work with Fiat Konaheng, you know, what is it that you look for in work that is coming your way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to work as a play to start with.
Yeah.
And, I'm interested in plays that explore new ways of sitting on the page, meaning that explores form mm-hmm. in a way that is already adventurous on the page.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not really, really interested in that slice of life,
yeah.
chasing drama.
Sure.
Type of thing,
yeah.
you know, unless there's something in it that
yeah.
really strikes
right.
at me, you know, and a piece like Jefferson's has tones of being realistic, you know, drama
yeah.
in that vein,
yeah.
But there's already so much happening at a language level,
yes.
that locates the work far outside of that space,
right.
you know, it
yeah.
sort of challenges you to think of it as something completely different. So that's something worth celebrating.
Mm.
And so the way language and form are handled are important
uh-huh.
to me.
Mm.
So I would first have to be drawn to that.
Mm.
And then, of course, the content. What are we saying?
Right.
What is this thing
right.
actually about?
Yeah.
And then we can have a conversation
mm.
with those three things.
So need. Language, form, and content.
Yeah.
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 And there's so much that
yeah.
I think can happen on the page or at a level of form.
Yeah.
And I feel like there are still those limitations that we have because Retako is string up a workshop, but it later, you know, lots of devised work and that sort of thing, and often that kind of work, highly more page. It
doesn't really work.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't really hold a literary experience.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm interested in literary experiences.
I see.
Because part of the goal is to continue to celebrate the idea that plays are also fun to read.
Yes.
That they should be self-contained experiences, come and so on. Even
yes.
though, of course, plays are written to be performed.
Right.
And that sort of thing. But I think they should still hold as literary experiences.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's, yeah, I think that's predominant.
Mm. So I think what comes up as interesting and resonant with what you're sharing is with the Red on the Rainbow, you know, and I'm going to ask you to share about this maybe in some detail, particularly considering how the project came about and the role of Vuyisile Mshutulu in ensuring that it then, you know, came to be. But what you're suggesting in terms of language, form and content is so strikingly present in that play, and that the characters when they're speaking, there's a separation between the actors and the characters that they are playing, and you know, you deal with this engagement very directly. You know, the actor, you know, then says, you know, it's almost like they're narrating the story while they are performing it, yeah. Right? And so there's a literary, you know, it feels like, you know, a Brechtian thing, kind of thing, where there's this, and maybe it isn't, you know, from your understanding of it, but when I was engaging with the text, you know, I felt this kind of notion of a distance between the performer who's, you know, portraying the character and the character's lived experience themselves, that, you know, produces an interesting question, considering the content itself, you know, considering the fact that it's based on a true story where you have, you know, this kid and his mother and, you know, this very deep relationship that gets ruptured through this moment of complete evil and complete insanity, you know, where a child is then killed and taken from this life, and this mother has to then reckon with, you know, what does it mean to, you know, grieve this loss. And I noted in the performance of it, there's a line particularly that I found very interesting, the notion of Dora's scream. And if I remember correctly, the scream wasn't necessarily something that was performed, it was narrated as well. You know, and so I guess I'm just curious around, like, how these notions that you are expressing as being important for people to present to you, you know, if they want to publish with you, how they are also active and alive in your own work, you know. So maybe just broadly an open reflection on the process, yeah, the Red on the Rainbow, maybe touching on some of these pointers.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, the play emerged from the experience I had with the German institution. There were two institutions, but the main one was the LCB, the Literary Colloquium of Berlin, which had, through Maxi Obechan's work, they had invited me to be one of four writers from different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the process of trying to write a play to speak to that experience, I was searching in many different directions, trying to locate, you know, what it is that I wanted to say at that point and why. You know, so I was interested in something set in the future in a way that was consistent with other things that I had done.
Yeah.
I was interested in speaking to the experience of the Berlin conference, the first one, not the Hitler one, but the other one, the Scramble for Africa.
Yeah, 1888, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm. I was interested in speaking to that in some ways, and I started. So I had many different starts, you know, six, maybe eight in total, attempts to get into an experience, and then feeling like, okay, that's not the one. It's not, all of which could easily be plays on their own if I
explored it.
Yeah, I
could
that to explore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I arrived at this one because I had a conversation with myself about what I was trying to explore for myself as well, and it felt like there was value in looking at characters and everyday people in a way that I had not before. Because when you do stuff set in the future and that sort of thing, it's always asking different things,
mm-hmm.
of you in terms of how you think of characters and story and stuff like that. But this felt like something that would be very, very different. But I'm uncomfortable with realism generally. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not. It doesn't. My body resists it. I've tried, you know. It doesn't feel right. Yeah. It doesn't feel right. It feels like I'm lying. Like it's, you know, something false when I try to go into that place. So it always feels like the theater must do other things. And, you know, I pay attention to what the body is saying, you know, where my imagination goes. But I know that realism as a point of departure is not far for me. So now when I started with this one, you may have listened to a reading of a small part of the beginning of this, where some of the ideas at a story level, the notion of a mother, you know, picking up soil, you know, bloodied soil, because she wanted to take
the sun's spirit,
every part of the sun's essence, essentially, to take it with her away from the place where he had died. So that image comes from that early draft, and in that draft, I had the presence of a woman who kept interfering with this world in some way, but she wasn't on this plane, and there was a play on Winnie Mandela somehow being present in the world of the story and somehow influencing this woman in some way, and that was in the early draft. But all of that was happening because I was trying to break the form, I was trying to break the logic of the everyday and present something, you know, bigger, because my own world isn't that linear and,
you know, formulaic.
I don't experience life in a way that's realistic.
Right.
You know, it's not that. Like, so much shit happens in my head, in my life, every day, that if I try to present it on stage, people would say, I'm not making this shit up. But it's my life.
Your experience. You know?
Yeah,
sure.
So then I'm always trying to find a way to be true to those experiences that I have, that I'm not, that I don't even talk about maybe, but that are just my life. So that was the first attempt at doing that. And then I had, years before, so I had a fascination with Mutobi Mutluatse's version of the suit, the one that they had done with Bang Simon years before. Because of the way that it's written, you know, what happens at a level of form when somebody has adapted a short story into a play, and they had tried to retain so much of the original language in it, so they end up with a kind of experience where the narrator's voice is still there, but it's shared among the actors, and in the context of the way it's done, it's even shared among the characters, because now Philemon speaks as, he's dressed as Philemon fully, he behaves in practice like Philemon in terms of what he does physically in the space, but he narrates from a third person point of view, so he narrates as a neutral narrator telling us a story, but he's commenting on the character that we see him to be.
Right.
So it's not an actor at a neutral level telling you a story. It's still coming.
There's a complicity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I thought that was interesting. So when I saw that and the ensemble way in which that worked, I was like, oh, this is exciting. You know, and I'd seen many other short stories become plays, and all of them always having some unique, interesting ways in which the narrator is being used. And this has been an obsession of mine, the idea of narration in a play and different ways in which a narrator can be used. You know, I've always enjoyed experimenting with that. When we did Ancobia, you know, it was the same kind of idea. We had the idea of this narrator who begins as, I'm going to tell you a story and I'm going to fascinate you so much. And then halfway through, the story overtakes the narrator and he somehow is subjected to some of the things he started telling us about, they are now unfolding in his real time, in his real world. And now that life of the story has taken over his own.
Right.
Now he's an observer in the world of the story that he began telling. And of course he interferes with it, he comes in to, you know, take the story forward or whatever it is, to comment on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, but now he's become a subject, a smaller part of this broader story that's unfolding, you know, in front of you. And that was an adventurous thing to try and do as a way of exploring what a narrator can do. And when you look at that, so other people, when they saw that play, they said, oh, Brecht, you know, I was not thinking about, I never think about, you know, Brecht or anyone.
Yeah.
In that way. But what they were referring to as Brecht is when you think of a play like The Good Person of Sichuan, the narrator or not the narrator. One, the water sailor, opens the play by telling us about, you know, whatever, who he is, the water sailor, the world he's in, and sets up the premise for us quickly, like, you know, the god, three important gods are expected, you know, in this city, and blah, 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 blah. And then quickly he moves to, well, is that them? Is that them? And then right there they appear, and he's in contact with them. And quickly he imagines they've seen his wrong, and therefore he's in danger. He flees. He's out. The story moves on. Without him. So maybe that's what they're referring to, the idea that a character in the story is addressing the audience about things in the world of the story, and then those things change stuff in some ways.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what the person who said, it wasn't just one person.
Yeah.
They kept saying that.
This impression,
So maybe that's what they were referring to.
Yeah.
But the idea of direct address is not Brecht.
Right.
It's not Brecht's invention. You know, it's not that's as old as, you know, the fables, so-called folk tales that our people told each other. You know, the idea that you can tell the audience a story, and while you're telling them that story, begin to play a part of it, embody a part of that story in and out in that kind of way. That's a convention that's very, very old.
You
know, it's not new.
Yeah.
And the argument that I was making when I was teaching the students at Vets was that the one hand that's sitting at that essentially are drawing from that very form.
100%.
You know, especially how it's the same. It's the same principle, you know, it works in the same way. It works, you know, in the same way to some extent.
Yeah.
But in the same way that Umpile does. But you know, so a lot of that, the first one ender arguably then is that, except it's not a one ender because the audience will participate, do whatever, you know. So the form, they are read, borrows from this space.
I see.
But what we have now is we have five narrators sharing the same story.
Right.
All of them operating as this narrator around the fire.
Yeah.
And then they have moments of getting inside the story they're telling you. The difference here, the third layer that this play has, is that there's also narration from the point of view of the character, which is not very different from what I'm saying the narrator in Ankobia does. You know, and of course other people might say that is Brecht, that is a Brecht thing. And I don't know, maybe it is, but it's a thing I've been doing for a long time. I know that a certain playwright once saw Book of Revelations and asked, who are they talking to? Why are they talking to the audience? But I'm sure you never asked that of Brecht.
Right.
But because he in his plays always finds a justification for why they're talking in the direction of the audience, because they're imagining that it's someone else. He fences that to be an accomplished superior logic, you know, but it's not. That thing is something that has been there in my work in many forms at different stages of the evolution of my plays. So I've never imagined Brecht to have anything to do with that, you know. And of course, this is a conversation that people like Femi or Shafusan have been, you know, having challenged Brecht a lot, you know, in his own writing, especially when this idea of a narrator and this idea of direct address comes in, you know, that for us, that when you look at just the what is the so-called folk tale, the sight of those experiences, you know, and I've said before that when you see a folk tale, there are two main things that academics have been able to do from what these two more have in them is, one, when you are looking at a folk tale, you are looking at theater. So you can argue for that as the site of performance for us, okay, where we can mimic other characters or animals, whatever,
right, you know, elements.
Sure. So it contains performance in it, contains theater and performance in it. Mm. But it also contains literature in the sense of prose.
Mm.
Because a hard-trotter story, you have to also describe and use language to paint all these images before you get inside the dramatic writing part of those things. Yeah, so it's in the work I contain those two ways of thinking about writing, the writing dialogue or how characters speak, and writing prose that describes. So those two are contained inside the experience of a folk tale. So for Rona, before colonialism, rebella hore no e ke yone novel le e ke play e ke eng, we experience those, you know, in that one harmony. And so this is another thing that the play then does. So, but what led to the third layer of it was inspiration from a certain play by a German, which made me, I was like, but this form, this is us, this thing that he's doing here. And the same thing that you're saying, they said, no, Brecht, this is, couldn't be more Brechtian than this, you know? And I was like, what do they mean, you know? And I was like, I want to see where this goes. So I brought that whole thing in there to say, this is, it felt to me like a reappropriation of something. Much more than, because it feels like it's not very far from that play, that it's in the suit from these other plays. It felt like this is home. So I was like, let's see what happens when we take this and stretch it towards a story. Is it different? So then it was after that experience and thinking about all these other things that the suit being, that I thought, maybe this is the form that can house this thing as a celebration of all these things. And everyone who read it, I was like, oh, you know, in Kuputa, African storytelling, like, yeah, but of course that's what it is. But how I hate Abona, Barakiabona, but actually this thing, we've been having
it. I mean, it's also the notion of Grotowski and Poor Theater, the notion of multiple characterizations, limited use of space and props and all these things, and you look at it, you think, but this is what my grandmother was doing, right? Without any context.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So that play then comes into being in that kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the story itself is something that I arrived at, and it just felt like, this is the story. You know, and then the more I wrestled with it, the more it wanted to depart from the original story. The more it felt like my own story wanted to write itself through that. And, you know, I found that I was writing my mother's story.
Right.
Because I had seen that woman, Mamache Mahlomora. The look in her eyes, the level, the more broken Mahache. The level of disempowered in there, I was like, oh no, that's not the story I'm writing. I wanted to infuse her with a certain capacity to rebel,
shake the world.
I didn't want to do a shame, a poor woman, you know. So of course I looked at my mother's qualities, and I recognize moments of that same brokenness, you know, when my other brother died. So I knew that it had to go to a different place from that. Yes, there will be experiences of that brokenness, but that can't be the story. You know, it has to go elsewhere. Also in line with the notion of resistance versus protest. You know, are you just going to complain about what is being done to you?
Yeah.
Or are you going to
do something about it?
Yeah, assume some agency and act on it in some way. So yeah.
And then what was Guisela's role in it?
So this was, the play had already been written.
Okay.
It had done what it had to do for the German experience. You know, it was adapted to a short film because there's COVID. So, you know, we were meant to go there to experience a rehearsed reading of, you know, each of these plays. But things became what they did. And
yeah.
So they all shot some film version. Of
is there any way we can see the film?
Yeah, I think somewhere.
Okay, no, we'll get the link. Yeah.
Yeah, so after Professor Yeta, Bali Kada, so I said with the play, and we were in conversation with Vicini about Arts Alive and that sort of thing. And so when that time for that came, I presented a proposal, and that was the beginning of the conversation about it, you know. And of course, he has seen most of the things I've done.
Yeah.
So he knows my work. So he didn't need proof that I will deliver the work.
Yeah.
You know, he just trusted that
it'll come through.
So then he helped with his office together to make it happen as part of the Afterlife festival that year.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. As my parting shot or my final question, it's a two-part question. What excites you about the future of South African playwriting, or the future of South African theatre? Maybe let's put it a bit broader, because not a lot of work makes it to the archive. You know, if anything, what excites you about South African theatre, and then where to, you know, next for you, you know? As the Arts Konakheng, what are you trying to achieve in the next, you know, 5 years or so? You know, or yourself as an artist, what are you looking forward to?
Yeah. Excitement.
Mm.
yeah, that's always, I mean, you know, it's such a contested terrain.
Mm.
Yeah. The theatre. I mean, of course, it's exciting that there are a number of people interacting with it. I love that. It might help contribute to how we resolve that question. Yeah, to bring people to the theatre.
Yeah,
that I think the level at which a number of people are interacting with it is an exciting level.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm loving that. Of course, there's still a lot of very difficult experiences, not so thought through things that are being put on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still also a lot actually of really exciting work that people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good place to start, I guess, because then once we figure out how to sell what we sell, we will be in a good place, because we do have things that we can sell.
Right.
We have things that are sellable.
Yeah.
We just have to bridge that gap and find out how do we actually sell this thing for what it is in the best way that it can be sold.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's hope there.
Mm.
And then the future of the company.
And your current curiosity, current and future curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm coming to the end of one phase of writing, and perhaps entering a newer one in terms of what I'm interested in or what I feel my place can be. You know, the kinds of things that I've been writing have been very difficult. Difficult is not the word, but I suppose stuff that is sitting, stuff whose source is pain.
Mm.
And so I feel like I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I have two things that I'm working on now that I feel like maybe will close that chapter for me, that I don't want to dig into that in the same way. You know, I'd like to make happy theater. to say this to, we still have this conversation a little later about a happy theater. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that look like?
Yeah.
You know, the philosophy of happiness, you know? And I feel like because of the nature, yeah, colonialism, you know, the apartheid and all the other things we still deal with now, pain, there's no shortage of pain.
Right.
There's no shortage of, you know, the difficult. And I think maybe that's the one thing we can think about in a different way in the theater. You know, maybe we can supply happiness. Not in a fickle, happy-go-lucky, forget what's going on type of thing. Yeah. But I think a way of processing the trauma in a different way, you know, because that's essentially what we're dealing with, you know. We're trying to process trauma and to make our lives lighter in some way. And so perhaps there's another way of coming into it, you know. I think I've had a conversation with you about what, we have had this conversation about what Ntate Hlomo, you know, was saying about sympathetic magic, you know. This idea that like creates like, you know, the idea that if you hammer too much of that darkness, that's where you stay, you know. You find it harder to create the alternative because that's the door you keep opening, you know. It's just there. So I feel like there probably is another, I know there is another place to go with the work itself. I just, and I'll get there when I'm there, you know. For now, I'm finishing these things because they are still part of the heaviness that I'm processing myself, and they're still part of the broader questions I'm asking myself about the society, but Black society in particular. You know, so I think I'll finish those things as a way of saying, okay, we're done with that now, let's look elsewhere. Let's see if we can actually just make people happy.
Are you hopeful?
As would a person?
Or as a person, yeah.
In general?
Yeah.
I think that's why my work is never actually just dark.
Yeah.
I mean, I never make bleak work.
Yeah.
I never, I can't live with that, with hopelessness. No, I don't think if I felt hopeless, I think I would have done something.
Yeah.
I don't feel hopeless.
Sure. Okay.
No.
Yeah.
I truly believe there's always something one can do.
Yeah.
Always, at whatever point.
Yeah.
However on the edge you are.
Yeah. There's always something you can do.
There's always a step you can take towards some kind of light.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah,
and I'm saying this because I'm imagining the darkness out there that people imagine.
Yeah.
I know my own.
Yeah.
I know my own pain, you know. I know how I negotiate and navigate it, you know, from day to day. So I don't, yeah, I'm not speaking of some fantasy version of it that can be negotiated or approached.
Yes.
Yeah, so I do. Every day I make a commitment to take one step forward, you know. Even on days where it's like,
it's not worth it. Yeah, I think on that note, it's a good place to end, you know, on that note of hope and looking for the one thing that you can orient yourself towards to make a little bit of light for this particular day.
Yeah.
All right. Tavaiz, thank you.
My pleasure.
And I'm hopeful that this won't be the last one.
There's a lot to say.
We'll
get there.
Definitely, and hopefully in a studio next time, I can give you your own mic and the like.
We'll get it.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Hey, Tara.